welcome to The Logistics Tribe. I'm Boris Felgendreer, founder of The Logistics Tribe, and today's episode is a deep dive into the current ocean freight crisis, which is one of the most important business topics of this year and maybe even of next year. A lot's been said about this topic, but today's show is certainly one of the most clear and comprehensive analyses that you will find on this topic anywhere. That's what I think. And that's because our guest today is Jochen Gutschmidt, who spent his entire career of 30 plus years in the industry on both sides of the aisle. He spent 2 decades at Maersk and another decade leading the ocean freight team at Nestle, the largest food company in the world. He's now at Sea Intelligence, a boutique maritime intelligence and analytics company, so it's hard to find someone that is closer to that space than Jochen is. Our host today is Jonah McIntyre, whom many of you may know from one of our latest Logistics Tribe podcast episodes, where I talk to him about his oftentimes very contrarian views on the world of logistics. If you haven't already done so, tune into that episode as well. But today, it's Jonah as a host, and he brings you Jochen Gutschmidt. Enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to the Logistics Tribe. My name is Jonah McIntyre, and today's guest is Jochen Gutschmidt. Jochen and I are going to be speaking about ocean freight procurement. He'll be sharing some of his insights, having spent decades in the industry, first on the carrier side with an impressive list of rotations through the world, and then later at Nestle doing global freight procurement. Okay, before we start talking about market conditions, I think those who haven't heard your name before would just like to hear, what is your background, Jochen?
Right. Yeah. Thanks, Jonah. Thanks for having me, first of all. And thanks for the quick intro. Yeah, I think it's true. Just half a year ago, someone made me aware of the fact that I've been in the industry for over 30 years now. So that was a little bit of a shock, I have to say.
Okay. Yeah. Decades indeed.
No, but the truth is, I have been in ocean shipping essentially all my life. I started my career as an apprentice with Hapag-Lloyd for 3 years. So that was a marvelous time, really down to the basics. That was in the 80s, really. And then I started, after that, I started what I think was a pretty international career. I started in South America, a little bit in the tramp business. Then went back to Europe, back to the liner industry, and I joined Maersk with Big Blue. I then remained for more than 2 decades, really, all around the place, really, in Europe, in Copenhagen, in Hong Kong, Singapore, Saudi Arabia as well. I had a stint. And then after just over 2 decades in ocean shipping, I jumped the fence, and because you know how it is, right? The grass is always greener on the other side, as they say.
Indeed, yeah.
And which in the beginning I thought was true anyway, but then I joined Nestle, a big food and beverage company, or packaged food as they call it as well, here in Switzerland, in their world headquarters in Vevey. And there was leading the global logistics procurement function for just short of a decade as well. So apparently I planned in decades. So I've been on the supplying side, on the shipping side, as well as on the shipper side. So shipping line and shipper side. So I know both sides pretty well. And then last year we got together with Sea Intelligence, and which is, I think, a fairly well-known provider of maritime intelligence and analytics. And we started an advisory function, and the timing was apparently fairly good, trying to help, based on that experience, trying to help global shippers or global market participants in riding this wave during this, you know, what one could call crazy time. So, but basically end-to-end advisory on procurement, operational management, improvement, execution, the whole end-to-end process on international ocean shipping. So that's what I do.
Okay, so you've had this career that's gone all over the globe with carrier operations, then procurement, and now you made this fortuitous switch to advisory in a period when in the last 18 months, advisory on ocean procurement must be through the roof, right?
It is, and you know, I think, you know, if I recap the last, six, eight months or so, a little more, that is, really the most frequent question that we get is, you know, when is all this over? And obviously that, you know, that's a question that's very difficult to answer. And I think nobody has the answers, really. I think we're going to talk, you know, about that a little bit during this podcast. But that is the most frequent and the most, well, difficult or perhaps even unrealistic or whatever question. I don't know what fits best there, but it's, but that's the big question out there. When is this over? When do we get to, you know, whatever you can call normal? Although that's a difficult term as well, normal.
So people are coming to you, they're asking, when are things going to return to normal? Before we get into that, this acute pressure, I want to hear a little more about the scene. So for people who aren't intimately following the ocean freight procurement space, we know that there's capacity crunch, we know that there's pricing pressure, but what is this? Is this a long-term trend that's been playing out over a decade or decades? Is it a midterm trend? Is it something that's really acute and related to the pandemic? You know, help us understand the big picture here before we get into the details.
Right. Yeah, good question, Jonah. I think in a nutshell, really, so what we are experiencing right now, what the market participants are going through, essentially is really predominantly a COVID-induced problem that just takes very, very long to kind of ease itself. So really the root cause is the epidemic developments that started last year. And that's what we are trying to get out of or trying to make peace with or trying to find our space. But that is only the last year. So that's kind of 10% of the last decade. And we have seen similar situations in 2015. It also depends a little bit, you know, what problems we're talking about. Is it congestion? Because there are lots of attributes that this situation has. It is disruptive overall. But so, which areas are we talking about? So, 2015, we had the labor crisis on the West Coast, as you may remember, and we had another, you know, a couple of other black swan events. I think we call them. The Hanjin bankruptcy, the cyber attack with Maersk Line, and so on and so forth. So we had plenty of crises, but otherwise, if you want me to allude on that, you know, what we have seen and what the trends and what the focus area were in the last decade, is that what you're after as well? Or
well, let me try to take it from another angle. So let's say that you've got your procurement officer, your supply chain officer, and they go in to visit their supply chain doctor, and the doctor sits them down and says, all right, so what's the pain? Why are you here? What are your symptoms, right? And okay. I guess let's start with, what are some of the things that are the acute pressures that are being placed on these people? Is it cost? Is it things moving, not moving?
Right.
Is it risk? What would they say are their main symptoms?
Right, okay. I got you. Yeah. So I think there are predominantly two things really that from a shipper's perspective, from an importer's or exporter's perspective, there are, I think, two key elements that prevent people from sleeping at night right now. One is operational disruption. So supply chains are broken. Nobody knows when are orders shipped? When do they arrive? When can they get on the shelf? So just really physical disruptions, delays, etc. So the physical reality of today's supply chain or physical supply chain environment, that's one thing on the one side. And on the other side, it is an amazing inflation in the area of ocean freight, but logistics expenditure overall. It's not only ocean freight, but obviously ocean is, I think, the key, you know, takes center stage of what we are discussing right now. So it's these two elements. It's terrible service at amazingly increased rates if you compare it to just a year ago. So that's why people spend a lot of time in PowerPoint making smart slides and try to explain, in an attempt to explain to their leadership what is going on. Those are the two elements.
That's pretty concrete. So a supply chain officer, logistics director, procurement director, there are two concrete pain points. They're going to be a breakdown in the physical flow of goods or a significant increase in their ocean freight rates. That's something I think everyone can relate to right now. I guess the next question is to what extent this is really outside the norm of our industry, because right, our industry always has something to talk about. It's fuel, you know, it's oil rates going up, it's a lack of capacity, it's Brexit, it's this and that. So are we really talking about a real change to the industry, something that has sort of never been seen before? Or are we talking about the flow, give and take, and supply demand that would normally be observed in the industry? And what's your view? Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that I don't believe there's pain here. Let's try to quantify it a little more.
You know, ocean shipping, you know, it's vessels going from, you know, from ports in one geographic area and then sailing towards another geographic area, which is a trade lane. So, you know, common trade lanes is Asia, Europe, or Trans-Pacific from Asia to North America. Those are the largest ones, or the most significant ones, or the most prominent ones, perhaps. And of course, every market has, you know, every market has their own dynamics. So there is not this one number, you know, that depicts how prices have increased in every possible global trade. Perhaps there is an average, but averages are obsolete in this context, I suppose. But let's look at the two key trades that people are mainly focusing on right now, which is from Asia to Europe, as well as from Asia to North America. You know, if we look at the spot market, you know, which brings me to another thing, I don't want to make it complicated, but obviously, there are folks who are in the so-called spot market. You know, they have a very dynamic trading environment, which means a lot of ad hoc, possibly short-term trades that they do. And, you know, as a consequence of this, they have to enable the supply chain. So people who buy on the spot market can pay prices that are as high as 800% compared to what they were a year ago. So anywhere between 600 and 800%. At the end of the day, it really depends also on which particular corridor even you do business. So those are obviously gigantic increases. But you know, it's only roughly half, I think, of the folks who actually transport things are in this segment. The other segment are contract customers, you know, who have their annual service contracts, again, on both trades, right? It doesn't, you know, there is not a big difference there. And for those people who continuously ship, you know, goods across the oceans with service contracts, there, I think, a point of orientation is that their freight rates probably roundabout doubled.
Doubled.
If you compare it to the previous.
And that's doubling as in they were renegotiated or in the next contract wave?
Well, you do this year after year in a way, right? So, you know, before a tender or before a contract is, or after a contract is before the next contract, right? So this is ongoing. This is an ongoing thing. And
got it. Okay.
And, you know, from people that I spoke to, that have these regular contracting periods on an annual basis or so, you know, their expenditures, their costs went up around about 100%. Of course, also there, it can deviate and maybe really, you know, different from customer to customer. But that seems to be kind of a rough number that, you know, that's what I'm hearing anyway. So doubling, which is significant.
It's amazing. I'm having a hard time imagining the budgets of these companies, which frankly underline the whole industry. But let me, without taking us too far off the path, let me just switch views for a second and say, for these interactions, these contracts and these spot rates, there's got to be somebody else on the other side, the counterparty, whether that's the freight forwarder or the asset operating carrier. And I'm curious, how is it for them? Are their costs actually increasing in line with these rate increases, or is this just bumper profits driven by excess demand that they can capitalize on with, you know, enlarged rates? So essentially, I'm asking the question, is this a crisis on the other side, or is this just massive opportunity for forwarders and asset operators?
Right. Good question. You have to differentiate between the physical asset provider, so the shipping lines that operate the vessels, and I think you mentioned forwarders or NVOCCs, as we call them, the non-vessel operator common carriers, you know, those who buy ocean freight and resell. So for shipping companies, I think it is fairly straightforward. This incremental revenue goes straight to their bottom line, as it is evident from their annual or quarterly reports that we have the pleasure of reading. As they come out. So there is a lot of evidence that it's really a golden year for shipping companies. Although I think, in all fairness, it needs to be mentioned that their costs are going up as well. And I guess we will be talking about this, like congestion and so on. I mean, these are incredibly costly disruptions for shipping companies as well. So not every dollar that they make incrementally compared to pre-COVID times is going straight into the bank. So their costs are also up, right? And for those brokers, for forwarders or NVOCCs, it depends a little bit. You know, the nature of a broker is they, you know, perhaps if somewhat simplified, you know, they always make their buck, you know, whether the market goes up or the market goes down, right? I mean, they always have this cut. And frankly, I think also most of the forwarders, their annual reports or quarterly reports suggest very healthy business development, both in terms of volume and in terms of profitability. So I think I don't want to call them beneficiaries of this, but they're also in a good space at this moment.
Right. No judgment, of course, on the fact that they've had these bumper profits. That's just market conditions. Mm-hmm. But I do wonder what they do with them now. So is this fueling, you know, M&A activity? Is there going to be further consolidation because of it? Is it just going back out as dividends? You know, that old thing that we used to do when things were profitable? Is it being used to pay down debt? Is it going into greening out the fleets? You know, the ocean freight industry has a long way to go to become carbon neutral. Where is this money being reinvested?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. Honestly, I think it's a little bit of both. But here, you know, I clearly want to label this. I'm not a shipping company, right? So I don't have to make these decisions. But let's see what we can see. You know, let's look at the market facts that are visible for everybody. So people are, and that leads me perhaps later on to allude to another problem. But obviously, people are ordering ships again. So, you know, last year, essentially nobody has ordered ships because everybody was, especially at the beginning, as we, you know, as the crisis got really, really serious and trade almost came to a standstill, one could say, or in China anyway. So nobody was even thinking about ordering vessels. And now I think, I don't have the exact numbers offhand right now, but I think the order books of yards are chock-a-block again. So obviously there's, although, you know, carriers never really had apparently any problem with buying ships even before the crisis or before the current market situation, but the order books are full, and it is even, I think, somewhat problematical to buy ships and to place orders at this moment. So they're doing this, and obviously, you know, this is very modern tonnage. I think just a couple of days ago, Maersk announced that they are ordering some vessels that can run on methanol, to your point of, you know, green shipping. So obviously, this migration, we have already seen it with over the last years. So this is completely unrelated to the pandemic. But there is a lot of pressure on the shipping industry to become greener, let's say, or even green, or, you know, CO2 neutral or greenhouse gas emissions neutral. But I think 2050, most of the commitments are 2050, I believe. And that will obviously have a cost tag as well throughout the operation, not just the vessels, but also terminals, etc. So the whole infrastructure will have to move on those points, and that will cost some money. So I think it's a mixed bag. For forwarders, I'm not quite sure. I mean, many of them are very asset light. So what you know could be interesting to both shipping companies as well as the forwarding space is the consolidation that you've mentioned, M&A activity. We are seeing this in the forwarding space. DHL has just taken over Hillebrand. And before that, Agility. So, Agility was absorbed by DSV, if I'm not mistaken. So there has been some activity, but I'm not sure whether that is really, due to the financial liberty these people have as a result of the pandemic. I doubt that, but it's not something I could say. It's not my area of expertise. But shipping companies definitely are investing. I think consolidation on the large within the top 10 segment or even top 15 segment, well, top 15 maybe, but top 10 segment, I I do not expect. Perhaps further down in the volume tree, maybe the one or the other carrier will be picked up. But otherwise, I don't expect any significant movement there.
So what we've got here described earlier is we've got these two pain points. The physical flow of goods is slowing down or becoming unreliable. The cost of physically flowing those goods has increased, 100 to 800% for ocean freight, which is substantial. Right. Most of that is going over to profits for the asset operators, maybe not so much for the forwarders. Now, you did mention that you think this was all triggered by the pandemic and not by larger trends. So I'd like to just double click a bit on that. What is the mechanic exactly, the mechanisms that you go from a novel virus and a pandemic that turns into a capacity mm-hmm. crunch and then evolve to this?
Right. Well, there was an evolution, I think, right? So how did it all start? So first quarter last year when the pandemic broke out and China, maybe I'm exaggerating a little bit, but just for the sake of making the point. So China essentially closed down. Trade almost came to an end. All the factories were closed. As a result of a demand in free fall, you could say, carriers significantly reduced the capacity that was deployed. Again, mainly coming out of China, because China is the factory of the world, right? So proportionally, the biggest part of the maritime assets are deployed to and from China. That lasted a couple of months. In the meanwhile, the pandemic also made its way to North America, to Europe, essentially. I mean, I don't have to tell you that. Everybody knows that. It went truly global. With impact on consumption in Europe, for instance, in North America, nobody was going out, nothing happened. So, just to exaggerate a little bit, let's say trade almost came to an end or to a standstill. So volume was very low. And then later in summer, as we came out of the first terrible wave of infection and disruption, people all of a sudden started to spend money again. And if I say people, I have to say people in North America. All of a sudden there was an amazing run to all the DIY stores in North America, I think, where people started home improvement projects and other things, because they couldn't go to restaurants, they couldn't travel, right? So there was a lot of cash apparently at their disposal, and they decided to spend it, as I understand they do quite frequently. So it's not necessarily a saving nation, I think. I don't know, but you may know more about that.
Well, it's funny, but you mentioned something that's really structural. So if you look at how the U.S. responded to the pandemic, there were these stimulus checks. They came early, they came frequently, there were multiple of them, and they were entirely focused on consumption. It was no one intended for those to go into savings, right, or retirement funds. It was supposed to be spent. And also, you had a more flexible labor market than in Europe. So everyone who's a cook or a waiter in the U.S. spent some time in Amazon fulfillment centers, right, because they were out of work, and the intention was they'd just go work someplace else. Whereas in Europe, you've got these furlough schemes, and the money from the recovery fund isn't even going to be dispersed until 2022 in most cases. So it's just different paradigm.
Yes, you are absolutely right in saying that. And so demand in Europe went down. It also, it was coming to a halt almost, right? But when people started spending again, it was nothing compared to the U.S. So the growth levels, the market or business growth levels we see in Europe in terms of volume, in terms of containerized trade, is back to normal growth levels that we had even before the pandemic. So the problem, which is like 2-3% or whatever in volume terms. However, the situation in North America was totally different. There we had, we saw double-digit growth ratios, 12, 13, 14% growth in volume terms. And this came all of a sudden. Coming back to, what's going on, what has caused all this? So in summer last year, when demand started to increase again, and it increased rapidly and intensively, containers weren't in the right space. Vessels had to be, reintroduced. So there was a wave of demand that the available capacity or the shipping companies, let's say, were really challenged to deal with. And this is where these disruptions come from. So, you know, they at this point, any conceivable capacity that is available, any container ship or even semi-container ships that are available in the market are deployed. So, which is different than before. So the capacity deployed right now is much bigger in nominal terms than it was before the pandemic. But it was this amazing demand that started in around about summer last year in North America that really disrupted and challenged the entire infrastructure, from vessels to ports to equipment. Because obviously you know how it is. That's the downside of containers, right? I mean, they are a great invention, but there is, you know, you need to deal with empty equipment, right? So you have, you know, all the imports that are coming into the U.S. sooner or later, they will have to, you know, you fill them with agri and whatever comes out of North America. But the vast majority of containers are going back to Asia empty, so they, you know, they can be filled again. And in North America itself, you also had lots of disruptions, terminal closures, you had factory closures. And so the time that equipment needs to arrive, to be, you know, unpacked, unstuffed, as we say, turned around and sent back to Asia empty, that time all of a sudden took much longer because there was more disruption along the way. And this is part of this of this problem that we're having. And the terminals were also disrupted because of COVID outbreaks, labor shortages, and many, many other things that prevented them from handling the incoming ships at a pace at which, you know, which they would have to handle them, so to speak. And I think right now there are 40 vessels in front of Los Angeles Long Beach, 40 container vessels waiting to enter the port or waiting berth so they can offload their stuff. So all this is...
Okay, but just put that in context for me. 40 vessels out of a base of how many? Like how many would it be on a normal Thursday a year ago or 2 years ago?
I would say none. I would say essentially.
Oh, wow.
I would
okay.
say no.
So it's yeah. zero. Okay.
So there should be no wait. I mean, occasionally there could be a day or so, but generally speaking, vessels, they will arrive and they will take their berth because everything has been planned through. So there shouldn't be any structural waiting time. Let's say
40 to zero. Wow.
But we clearly see this, and these disruptions and these delays, they're eating up a significant amount of capacity that is deployed, and you know this can go up to 10%, 10% roundabout, give and take, 10% of the total capacity deployed is kind of absorbed by all these disruptions, these delays, and so on. And obviously, this is then capacity that is missing.
Wow, that's such an interesting point that you've got this mismatch of supply and demand, where you have too much demand anyway. And in place of just being able to run as yeah. you know as full as possible, you're saying that because of these sort of congestion issues, it even reduces the carrying capacity of the supply, because the ships get there, they're laden, they instead of turning them around and bringing them back with more goods on their sailing loops, they have to just hold anchor, I guess, off the coast, waiting for the port to have berths for them. That's super fascinating.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But then again, also, I think it is important to say that, you know, we were talking about the inflation in ocean freight and so on. Obviously, as I said, it's not only ocean freight, right? It's throughout the entire supply chain, or physical supply chain, let's say. Plus, and you may have read about this in the news, or you may even have seen it or realized it in your local grocery store, that a lot of costs for materials, for commodities, have also gone up at the same time as has the you know the cost for energy, right? Everything went up, so it's not only ocean freight that went up. Yeah,
we've seen that in general business, right? So we see that all forms yeah. of inputs are increasing in cost. We have this across the board inflation, but particularly in the U.S., but really globally as well, and I could understand how that would relate to some of the rise, but you know, 100 to 800% in this time period, that is a story in and of itself around ocean freight. Now, let me try to recap what we've heard until now. You're saying that supply chain owners, procurement professionals, they will be experiencing a 100 to 800% rate increase right now. That's their pain. And that this pain really relates back to the pandemic as its root cause.
Yeah.
And that the mechanic of how it relates back is that first China, so the global factory, world's factory, first China had the pandemic, and that shut down factory operations at the very beginning. So supply dropped. Then, of course, the pandemic went to other places. Then their demand dropped. The operators, the carrier operators, took capacity out of the system in reaction to this new world. And then demand went way up faster, went up faster than expected in places like the U.S., and supply just wasn't there. I mean, it wasn't there in the factories, but it also wasn't there in ocean shipping, so carrier capacity, and that we're still working through the backlog of that surplus demand. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah. In a nutshell, that's I think that hits it on quite well, yeah, that's it.
So essentially, we have a situation that's painful today. We know the approximate cause for it. But what I'm hearing you say is that it kind of sounds temporary. Like, to me, it sounds like this is something that will resolve itself given time, as demand either comes down or supply eventually catches up. I'm wondering if there's anything else here that makes it a fork in the road moment where the industry just won't be the same anymore because of this.
Yeah, well, that's that's the million-dollar question, I think, right? So, you know, that's the challenge with forecasts, especially as they relate to the future. But, you know, I tend to at least I try to be a realist on these things. So, so what we will be seeing, I think, in the future is, you know, carriers have. You know, what they've done last year in terms of taking some of the capacity out as demand just vanished almost, right? They've done this before in order to, let's say, manipulate the market in their favor, right? Just, you know, reduce supply, you know, just to keep ocean freight rates, you know, coming to a level where they could possibly make a profit. And they got quite good at that. And if I say quite good at that, then I mean, you know, they can do it very quickly. They do it very professionally in a very structured manner. So I believe this is here to stay. I also believe that the current demand profile that we see, again, predominantly in North America, to be honest, I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's sustainable. So it will, you know, that is, I think, North American consumption or demand will come back to, you know, what we may as well refer to a normal level of consumption, I believe. Okay, then there is still a little bit of a gap because inventories in North America are also very low. You know, so I'm sure that, you know, especially in e-commerce and so on, you know, people will be looking at replenishments a little bit. So that will keep this demand curve pretty high for a continued period of time, possibly even after demand kind of normalizes. But it will normalize. And I think in Europe, we have to, you know, this demand peak or strongly increasing demand is something we either yet have to see because we haven't seen it, or it is not coming because, you know, people in Europe will spend their money on other things such as travel. Much more than Americans. So,
You know, so not on the physical goods.
You know, exactly. Rather than, you know, buying stuff, let's say.
So it's essentially a service economy. You're saying that the concentration of the buying in Europe is around services rather than the physical goods.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That's what I believe. Why do I believe that? Is because people have also in Europe, people said, you know, we had so much time home office, so they were doing home improvement and stuff like this as well. But maybe they do it differently. But, you know, we simply haven't seen this explosion in demand. So quite frankly, if we see it going up, I mean, apart from the normal seasonality, you know, for Christmas or so, that I don't expect it to be as wild, so to speak, as we have seen it or are seeing it in North America. Because again, because they will spend their money in more in the service sector. So back to the carrier. So I think, you know, very disciplined capacity management is something that that carriers will do because, you know, they've never had anything like this before, I think ever really. You know, they are coming out of a decade of essentially EBIT neutrality. I mean, there was no real money made in global liner shipping over the last decade, at least not to any shareholder satisfaction. So I truly believe that, you know, they can't retain rate levels that we see at the moment, but they will definitely do whatever they possibly can to absolutely prevent the market to going back to where it was pre-COVID, where we had an overcapacity, overcapacity environment, and people were barely making any money. And they will do this through very diligent capacity management, because that's essentially all they can do, right? It's an asset heavy industry, right? So that will stay.
But you mentioned something that's very fascinating. Anybody who's been around this industry over the last 10 to 20 years would know that carrier asset owners have really not turned the kind of profit that anyone expects. They simply have not been a profitable business. And I don't mean cyclically, I mean over the long haul, right? We can come back to the discussion of how intentional that was, but the reasoning has always been the same. It's, as you said, it's the only thing they can control is capacity. It's a supply side driven question about the profitability. They've simply added at kind of every key moment, they've added too much supply, right? They've built too many ships, they've built larger ships, and they've brought the rates down. Now, when I look at market conditions like they are now, rates are 100 to 800% higher and goods are still moving, I sort of wonder if leadership in these businesses or the backers of these businesses are just going to say, hold the rates. You know, why, if they can ship it 100 to 800% higher now, then they can keep doing it next year and the year after and so on, right? If there's people willing to fill the boats at those rates. So I guess a question is, can they not do that? Why couldn't they do that? And then if they're not going to, if there's something that's going to knock the rates down, are they going all the way back to where they were pre-pandemic? Or is there going to be something in between, something north of that?
Well, I certainly believe that they will end up north of what it's been pre-COVID. I'm absolutely convinced. But I think they can't, and neither do they have the aspiration to maintain current rate levels in the spot segment, as I've mentioned before, right? Very important. So these $15,000, $18,000, $20,000 rates that you read about, it's only a market minority that actually pays that. Or it's just a part of the market that pays that. So by all means, no, they will be north of what they paid or what the market level was pre-COVID. And frankly, it also has to be north of what a common rate was pre-COVID. Because as I said, you know, shipping companies coming out of a decade of essentially no significant profits. So, and they need to invest into modern tonnage, into modern equipment, into sustainable technology. So all this has a cost tag. So, you know, frankly, and I was on the other side of the fence, so I took advantage for almost a decade of these low prices, but at the same time I knew, and I also mentioned it, you know, that essentially this is not sustainable. I mean, we are in an environment where money is available at essentially no cost, right? So they were always able to kind of renew their ships and everything, and they did so much more than they would have had to, but of course you need to generate a profit, and you know, who wouldn't have that aspiration? But these and I'm sure shipping executives would agree that of course these the rates that we are seeing right now they're just a product or a consequence of the current reality. It is not where and I think there is a little bit of exploitation as well, frankly, on the carrier side, but they are not realistic. These are not realistic rates, you know, once things kind of come down a little bit. You know, will it be you know, 50% higher than pre-COVID or whatever. I don't really want to shoot a figure, but it's going to be clearly higher than what it was pre-COVID, I'm sure. Because this cycle, you know, that one, you know, some folks may suggest that the cycle that is becoming visible again now, so lots of income, you know, market is in the favor of the carriers, they have a lot of cash, they go out, buy new ships, creating overcapacity, with, you know, and the logical consequence should be that rates go into a free fall. This is what they will try to prevent, because this is what happened over the last decade or so, right? It was always the same cycle. And obviously this is not sustainable. So I don't think it will happen.
One of the things I think, though, to mention is that these organizations, these asset-owning carriers, when they were putting out more capacity, driving, as you said, prices into free fall, you know, they knew that they were driving the prices into free fall. They were essentially playing a war of attrition, a price war, in which they would put out larger ships, you know, these huge ships, modern ships that would have lower fuel costs, for example, and then drive the price down towards the, you know, the barely break-even point on those ships even, and piece by piece drive out their competition, either truly putting them out of business or making them amenable to to an acquisition, right? So when I look at this, I kind of wonder, can't they just go back to that strategy? In other words, imagine World War I, another war of attrition. I kind of imagine if they had had a break where everybody for 18 months could sort of rest and feed and put grains into their granaries and recruit fresh troops and re-equip, they might have just gone back into the trenches, you know, 18, 24 months later, restocked and started the war of attrition all over again. You know, do you see, I guess the question to you as an expert in the domain is, do you see anyone else coming out now, any of these players coming out and out of the gates, out of this cycle, and simply going right back into the war of attrition to increase market concentration and drive out their competitors?
Yeah, well, I think that's a good question. I think nobody has, I don't think anybody has that strategy. I mean, the fact of the matter is that large cash and profit heavy or cash heavy carriers could sit it out longer, you know, if market dynamics went clearly against them again in, say, whatever, a year or so, right? So they could, they would have the capacity, they would have the strength, the financial strength, to sit it out at least longer than others. Of course, you know, that I think that's the same in any industry. So this is not specific to ocean shipping, really. But
what you're saying is that even these companies that previously were in intentional price wars, now that they've restocked their capital, you don't think they're going to resume that?
No, I don't think so, and I would not hope so. I mean, maybe that would have been possible, you know, 15 years ago or something, or 10 years ago, but I don't think it is, you know, because they already came out of a phase of unprecedented consolidation. You know, if you look at a couple of years back and you see, you know, the carriers that were around during those times, and if you look at the market structure right now, you have, you know, the top 10 carriers have more than 80%, clearly more than 80% market share. So I think the appetite, you know, among these top 10, the appetite and the opportunity for more M&A, I question, but that is my personal opinion. So I don't think this will happen, no matter what some executives, you know, may think or strategize for. But I don't think this is happening. But again, you know, my opinion, because it would be a capital destroy or a money destroying strategy, right? It will come at an incredible cost tag. So, and that's what I said before. I think that is what they will try to prevent. I mean, these rock bottom rates, you know, that barely break even or even loss giving. So, I mean, there is no incentive to allow the market to, you know, to go back to those levels again. And I think, you know, if I may, you know, there is, okay, there are shipping companies and they are controlling capacity. But I think also the market, you know, the market is two things, the shipping companies on the supplying side, and it's the shippers on the demand side. So, and shippers really had the upper hand over the last decade, quite clearly. I had it, and I, you know, I was there. I know exactly what I'm talking about. And I think those days are also counted. So I think the relationship between shipping companies and shippers will also evolve as a result of this pandemic. Because, you know, and we need to focus a little bit on the demand side here as well. You know, what are shippers doing to deal with the situation? What have they learned? What lessons or what experiences have they made over the last year and a half, one could say? And you know, how is that implicating their future strategy? So, and I think that there was some recognition. And despite these whole rates, there is a lot of recognition and understanding also out there on the shipper side that obviously shipping companies should not return, and it's difficult to return to business practices, you know, that were seen before the pandemic, because shippers were part of the problem, right? So they will have to come out of their shadow, step out of their shadow, and beef it up a little bit as well in terms of their business practices.
So if I recap this, if I try to paint a picture around what you've described, you've got an industry with acute pains right now, root cause in the pandemic and an imbalance in supply and demand, but it's producing bumper profits for the operators, maybe not for the forwarders, but for the asset owning carriers. But you think that what's going to happen here is we're not necessarily a fork in the road. It's going to simply be part of the evolution of the industry.
Yeah.
And that what's going to happen now is we're going to arrive at kind of a new place, not this place forever, not go back to pre-pandemic, but something in between.
Yeah, I think, you know, one lesson, if I can just chip in there, I think one lesson really is that people on the demand side, so shippers, supply chain leaders, they have been reminded how sensitive the network is and how important ensuring supply is, right? So, you know, the last decade was purely a focus on cost. And if this crisis has done one thing, among other things, but one big thing, is it brought global trade and transportation on page one. So even the, you know, the ordinary dude walking the high street knows about this, you know, the ever given Suez event and how it impacted global trade and what the market dynamics were following that event. So I think there is much more awareness within supply chain leaders or among supply chain leaders that, you know, what is happening in this industry, how critical and crucial it is. You know, maybe they knew before, but now over the last 10 months or so, they were painfully reminded of how important, what role container shipping plays in their business. And I think that will also lead to, you know, more, how can I say, more market related and realistic behavior going forward. And if not, shippers will also be forced into this space a little bit. And there again, the shipping companies will try to, you know, to use the momentum to not allow shippers to do or act as they have in the past, pertaining to forecasting, no-shows, special terms, free time, all these kind of things. I think those days where you could just write up your terms and conditions as an international shipper and every shipping company would accept those, I think those days are over. And I think supply chain leaders will realize that, or have realized that.
Oh, that's a super fascinating point. You know, regardless of where the rates land, just term and condition changes could be the move,
true,
right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm just now going through my mind, I'm thinking of all those terms, those demurrage days, the free days, the, you know, everything, all these little nuancy terms, which, you know, we think of as bilateral things, but actually overall create really systemic problems on the supply side, just make it very, very difficult to have a optimized network. And a change in that would be, it'd be foundationally shifting the ocean market in ways that probably outsiders don't understand, but insiders would realize, oh wow, that if we could standardize that stuff and make them frankly more advantageous to the supply side optimization, could be huge. But I'm just having a hard time even imagining what the freight market would look like without all of these niche bilateral agreements.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think that's where, you know, procurement leaders are scratching their heads, is because, you know, it takes quite some time, you know, to change your attitude, right? And let's not forget, shippers are coming out of a decade where they had the upper hand, right? And I'm perhaps simplifying a little bit, but they could ask for anything and everything almost, right? Of course, they would have to agree on a rate, but otherwise, it was a pretty free world out there. And I think, as I've mentioned, I think those days are over, and people, and I'm sure, you know, the larger the companies and the more dependent they are on global ocean transport, they're already starting now. Actually, I know this from some of the clients that we're talking, they are already sitting down now, or they have started already a month ago to strategize, you know, for their go-to-market strategy coming, you know, Q1 2022, right? And so, you know, it's going to be challenging. It's going to be very, very challenging. And, well, not to say interesting, but that's just, you know, that's putting it very neutrally, so to speak, right? But nobody has experience in a market environment like this on neither side, right? So this is new to people. This is a black swan event in itself, one could say, a commercial one.
Okay, so you paint an interesting picture. You paint a picture in which the supply side really increases in strength relative to procurement, right? So freight procurement. And that one of the ways you see that playing out is a more active attention, kind of novel attention being paid from procurement towards the needs of the supply side. So rather than just dictating their own terms at market rates, you're expecting a sort of a normalization of terms, as well as rates, frankly, ending up at a higher level than they were pre-pandemic. And you said earlier that you don't think any other companies are going to return to their price aggression.
Yes.
In the absence of a price war, you still don't see that those individualized terms will be the way that people will be competing. Instead, it's going to be actually a shift. Instead of competing for the demand, there'll be a shift to sort of optimizing the supply through things like, you know, normalizing contract terms. Is that right?
Yes, these are some points. These are some points. I mean, obviously there are many, many others, right? But these are definitely some points that I think people will have to confront and find a mutual relationship, right? And one could also say a couple of relationships will probably need some repairing before they sit at the table again to talk about the future. But yes, absolutely. That's what I believe. Yeah, it's going to be a new reality in Q1 next year. A little bit comparable, perhaps, with already, you know, what people already experienced this year, because there was a contracting season during Q1 this year. Also, a lot of contracts had to be renegotiated, right? Because the contracts were not sustainable. The carriers hadn't kind of found their space yet in realizing, like, hey, you know, this is the new reality. I can do things that I could never do before, at least not the last 10 years. So there was, you know, a lot of relationships were damaged, but a lot of contracts also had to be renegotiated during Q2. And I think, yeah, coming the next contract season, I think, you know, some of the procurement leaders will be much more devout, so to speak, as they sit together. Hopefully they can sit together, and if not, by video conference, as they talk business for the shipping season 2022-2023, right? So, yeah, and finance okay. Managers too.
Yeah, let's transition. Last question here. I want you to think about somebody in the industry So I'm always wondering for myself anyway, what's the play? What's the play from this moment? How does someone become a hero in their organization or in their industry out of the conditions that they're in front of them? So let's think about somebody specifically listening to the podcast who might be in a shipping organization, procurement or operations, the other one, or someone who's in a freight forwarding organization, probably more in leadership or sales. And what kind of coaching or mentorship could you give to them? What would be a tactic or a play that they might think about bringing to their organization in order to become a hero there, in order to really accelerate their, you know, their career, their, you know, their standing in that organization? What are some of the recommendations you have?
Right. That's a very good question. I think those who, and this sounds a little strange perhaps, but those who control their business the best will be the winners. What I mean by that is those market participants, those shippers, importers and exporters that are able to manage their business the best in terms of forecasting, in terms of actually delivering what has been committed, in terms of, managing that contractual relationship with shipping companies, and those that also manage their operations the best, those will be the happy dudes, but they will have, clearly they will have an advantage now over those who don't. And there are many who don't, because again, they never had to live with this degree of discipline. Everybody always said, you know, yeah, it's very important to have the relationship. We always try and so on and so forth. But now, you know, the shipper will be much more accountable, I could say, going forward than they have been in the past. So those who excel in that new reality with all that spotlight, they will be on the winning side. For forwarders, I'm a little hesitant to go into that because I don't see, frankly, I hope I'm saying the right thing here, but I don't see the role of the forwarder to evolve that significantly, because I don't see their role changing. Why should it change? It's just new market dynamics that we see, but the role of a forwarder is still there. But also there, I believe the better they manage their business, the better they will be. The better they will be positioned to handle the next contract season or the immediate future, the midterm future, let's say. That probably doesn't answer your question entirely, but that's at least my first thought on what comes to mind.
Well, let me play it back to you. What I hear you saying essentially is that the separating criteria, the defining criteria between those who will have played this market situation well and who didn't is how active they were.
Yeah.
So essentially you're saying that the folks who are going to come out of this with a strong CV, strong resume, description of how they, what they did in 2021 are going to be people who were forward-looking, who weren't reacting simply to the failures of their procurement or of their relationships with carriers and operations, but they were looking into the future of and taking measures for them.
Well, yeah, I think you can only fix, you can only fix the future if you are aware of your gaps in the past, right? And what they meant to your business. And you mentioned the CV. So I didn't mean this from a career management perspective, but I mean this from a business success perspective. And obviously, if we talk about this industry, there ought to be a very close relationship between procurement and the folks in the physical supply chain, the people that execute. And there is a strong correlation. All the data, all the information, only the whole insights that procurement needs comes out of the operational business, right? So that's all the intelligence that the procurement people need to go to market and to create their boilerplates and their terms and conditions. There's all these buzzwords that I usually try to avoid, like insights, like transparency, like visibility, like agility, like resilience, right? So all this needs to be, all this is on the table to maybe achieve some sort of resilience and agility, right? Because you will need both in order to manage or to weather the storm, so to speak, and to navigate and manage your business successfully, also under these very, very difficult circumstances. So it's a lot about capabilities, and now this is also stuff for, you know, this could be another call, really. We didn't talk about digitalization and what happened and how did people evolve, and but there is a lot of capability that is needed to really have a convincing and robust go-to-market strategy for the next shipping season. So that's really what I see on the shipper side. Carriers will be busy with, you know, trying to understand where is demand heading and how do they and how should they position themselves and how disciplined will on the carrier side, how disciplined will the market participants be with regards to what we've discussed before in terms of capacity management, because there is an awful lot of capacity coming into this industry from at least 23 onwards. So, and that is not too far away. So, you know, it's a lot of things happening on both sides of the fence, so to speak. There is also, we haven't discussed this, infrastructure, terminals, you know, what are they supposed to do and what can they do? But you know, I just tend to focus on shippers and carriers at this point in time.
This has been really fascinating for me. I'm sure that people listening have gotten something out of this somewhere along the way. So I want to thank you. Hopefully we get to do this again, Johan. So maybe a year from now, we'll come back. We'll check where market conditions left us, and maybe we'll be dumbfounded we didn't see the next capacity crunch.
That would be cool. Let's meet, you know, let's mark our calendars in exactly 1 year. We get together again, John.
Exactly. Okay. Well, until then, though, really, really appreciate your time. And thanks again for appearing on the podcast.
I appreciate it. And thanks for having me. Really, really appreciate it.
All right. That was our ultimate analysis of the global ocean freight crisis with Jochen Gutschmidt and Jonah McIntyre. I hope you found it as interesting as I did. If so, please consider giving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. And please subscribe to the Logistics Tribe podcast so you don't miss any of the future episodes. I'm Boris Felgendreher. Until next time.